I think it took a few times. So welcome to the last formal talk of our five-day retreat. So this is October 23rd in the afternoon, the Wisdom and Compassion Retreat. And we've been exploring all kinds of things around wisdom, compassion, mindfulness, and so on and so forth. I am going to stick fairly close to my script, says she. It may have occurred to you, or you may be wondering, why we haven't said anything about wisdom. You know, there's that W word that just hasn't come up, right? And, you know, we've talked a lot about mindfulness. We've explored the four ways to establish mindfulness, or the four frameworks within which you practice mindfulness. Today, Frank talked about love. He didn't use the L word either, but the four, you know, the four Brahmaviharas are about love. They're about how to truly love somebody or oneself or the world, and the world. So I thought I'd start there, given, you know, we're at the end of the retreat and maybe I should say something about wisdom. But it's sort of been implicit in everything that we've been doing. And, you know, the scientist in me doesn't always trust implicit training because we know from various psychological research that vicarious learning doesn't work. You know, you think the person is picking up the rules, but maybe they're generating their own set of rules. So you kind of have to... We know that it's the old parental thing, you know, don't do what I do what I say. Right. So over this week, we've been practicing the awareness of breath, and we've been focusing on that. Now, the awareness of breath is what we call concentration training, or shamatha. So shamatha is concentration training, and it allows us to not become tangled up with our mental formations. In our group today, I talked about pachancha. You know, pachancha is that craving, that agitated greed that needs to have everything go our way or everything taste the way we want to taste. Interestingly, I discovered yesterday that the cookies I love so much were not only were they gluten-free, but they also contained coconut. I hate coconut. But I thought the cookies were amazing until I found out they contained coconut. Well, I hate the desiccated coconut. So those are mental formations, preconceived notions, self-criticisms, you know. Why didn't I tell everybody about this internet thing, right? Okay. As we practiced shamatha, we were also practicing, eventually, as we got through it, we were also practicing insight or vipassana. So vipassana is insight meditation, and it can go two ways. The misconception of vipassana is that if I just, you know, when I sit and breathe and I allow my mind to open up, all of a sudden this, you know, inherent wisdom just blossoms forward and I can go become a guru and I can, you know, be like Frank or something like that, right?
Nobody wants to be like Frank.
But you do want to be Frank. We're getting to the last day here. We're getting a little punchy, you know. So, but vipassana, the whole practice of vipassana, especially if you're going to Goenka tradition, and, you know, which is, I think somebody mentioned the 10-day Vipassana retreat, you know. I mean, that's an amazing retreat to go on and just for the experience itself. It's the practice unfolds so that we connect with the inherent unreliability of everything. Impermanence is inherently saying you can't rely on anything to stay the same, right? Non-self says you can't even rely on yourself to stay the same, never mind the world, right? Suffering says, and I always misunderstood this, why would we say impermanence, non-self, and suffering? Why would we say insight was the insight of suffering when it's already the first noble truth? So I kind of feel like, okay, Buddhism tends to repeat itself all over the place, but then there are little subtle issues in translation that you have to pay attention to. The insight into suffering is that I am my own obstacle. I create most of my own nonsense. The world contributes, right? It contributes to a certain degree of variance, a certain percentage of the variance of my suffering. But the vast majority of the variance of my suffering is self-generated, right? I wish I hadn't known there was coconut in the cookies. I'm not going to enjoy them as much this afternoon. But ha-ha, I got the chocolate chip ones. I'm sure a whole lot of you got the raisin ones. Does someone say betrayal is discovering that what you thought was a chocolate chip was actually a raisin? I totally agree with that. So insight into the fact that I am the master of my own suffering, I am the mistress of the creation of my own suffering, is where the wisdom arises. So in that sense, yes, you know, the Vipassana practice is we see the fleeting nature of the world, right? But for me, it goes further than that. Impermanence is not just a concept, but we experience it, and that's our practice. We have to experience it unfolding in every moment, every single moment, right? Here it is, whatever it is, it's gone. That's the practice of impermanence, is to notice that moment of gone. The mindfulness teacher, the Zen teacher, I think it's a Zen teacher, Shenzhen Yang, talks about watching, listening for that moment when it's gone. That's the outer bell. When I asked you today, don't move until the bell has stopped. Not only is that in most retreat centers an issue of a practice of respect, it's also a practice of impermanence. Can I hang in until I notice gone? It's the same with the emotions. Can I hang in till I notice gone? Right. There's that steadiness being the flagpole. Okay. So gone is a wonderful practice. It's a practice of impermanence. Because everything has a gone moment. The taste of that cookie has a gone moment. Right. Non-self is not just an idea. You know, we can talk about, you have a navigational self, so which is really handy because you don't walk into your neighbor's house and think it's yours. You know, you don't take things that are not freely given because, hey, you know, none of us have a self, so everything belongs to everybody. I really like your BMW. I'm taking it, right? So non-self is not just an idea. It's also a practice of gone. Right? It's a practice of seeing that angry self arise and not acting until some much of it is gone, allowing the wisdom of where that what that anger is intended for to arise. Right? It's having that anxiety arise and waiting for that moment of gone. Right? So these are not philosophical concepts. Right? We can argue all day long. I mean, there are conferences. There are world-renowned conferences where people gather in one place and debate and argue and throw things at each other over things like, does the self really exist? You know, can you ever step in the same river twice? People get really worked up over this stuff, right? I just wait for the gone. How I create suffering is just not another occasion for us to engage in shame and blame. My favorite twins, other than sloth and torpor, are shame and blame. Yeah. Actually, they're quadruplets. They all hang around together, right? So it's about, you know, suffering is about noticing gone. When do I put down that bludgeon and stop, you know, that second arrow? I mean, I think a lot of you resonated with the idea of the second arrow. When do I put down that second arrow and then notice, oh, my suffering's gone. It'll come back, don't worry about that. Right? You've never lost it. But at least I know it has the capacity for gone. I wanted to say to a little bit off to the side and off script, along with the second arrow, and this is really important because we live in such an intellectualized society. You know, you're valued for what you know. If you work in a particular data-driven organization and your boss comes to you and says, "So how's that project going?" and you say, "Well, you know, I haven't figured out what the researchers were wearing in that other lab, so I don't know if I can actually pull the data together. I don't really want to run the analysis right now because, you know, I don't know what they're going to be serving for lunch and how that's going to affect me. You know, so I really don't know. I don't know how this project is going." You probably wouldn't last very long in that job, right? But we value absolute information. How's the project going? It's going really well. We've got all this together. We can call the meeting tomorrow. We've got our client ready, and we're ready to roll this out. That's what people want to hear. Right? But when it comes to our own pain, right, and you've probably experienced this, and certainly I've experienced it personally and in my clinical practice, people don't come in and say, okay, I've been diagnosed with depression. How do we fix this? How do we get this rolling? Right. I need to be done in 3 weeks so that I can be back at work enjoying my life. Off we go. Get going, Dr. Montero. Please tell me what to do. Right. Very few people do that. Right. Well, I get suspicious what they do. I think they've taken one of our courses and they've been listening to me. Right. What we do is we say, I don't know how I got here. I don't know how I got here. I mean, I've been depressed before, but I didn't think I'd ever get depressed again. So I need to know how this happened so I can make sure it never happens again. But why did it happen? Why now? I was so happy, you know? My wife, my husband, my children, you know, everything has worked out well. You know, or yeah, you know, my parents are retired and they're not bugging me anymore about things. You know, they've moved to some, you know, Canary Islands or something and I'm really happy. Why am I so depressed? Or even, you know, sadly, you know, my partner who's been suffering for so long with a physical illness is, you know, has passed on. And yes, I'm grieving. But, you know, this was 10 years ago. Why am I so depressed now? Why am I so anxious? It's that why question. Give me a reason, a straight line as to X happened and then it led to Y. So in the Buddhist sort of parables, it's kind of like, or metaphor, it's kind of like someone who's been pierced by that arrow, right? It's the second arrow, but doesn't want the arrow pulled out until they know who shot it, what castaway were they in, what was the arrow made of, who made the arrow, what were the feathers, who was the Fletcher who put the feathers on this arrow, right? What was the tip made of? How far away was this archer standing? What was their lineage? Who did they train with? How did they even end up being there so that they could shoot me? We get stuck in needing to know peripheral information as if that gives us power. So it's not just about the second arrow, it's not just about the fact that we react with the second arrow, but that often we resist being treated for the obvious wound, because we want to be educated as if that's going to protect us. And to some degree, education protects. Psychoeducational work around depression and anxiety is very helpful. But I've spent many a session cycling over, but why? But I don't understand. Or even more seductive, I really appreciate all your training and education. I was just wondering if you could just let me know. Because, you know, the assumption is I've got the secret and I'm just not going to let them know till my yacht is paid off, right? We don't have a yacht. So it's really important. The second arrow is not just about knowing that I'm doing something to myself that's exacerbating the situation, but also that I may be resisting in very tricky ways. Okay. And even there, it's very nice to see when that's gone. Right? Oh, I don't need to know how I got here. I just need to know that I'm here. Because if I'm worried about how I got here, then I start learning all kinds of techniques and throwing it at the problem rather than sitting with the problem and resolving it. So we started with mindfulness because that's the stance to our experience. It's the second arrow. It's the secondary process, mental process of needing to get some distance from the problem. So we go intellectual. We take the elevator up to the top of our heads. As we learn with mindfulness, but it's the stance to our experience, it opens us to our skillful and unskillful actions. Right? It's not just about becoming skillful and warm and fuzzy. It's also about knowing our unskillfulness. And in three areas, our actions, our thoughts, and our speech. Those are the relational components, right? My actions, my thoughts, and my speech. My thoughts drive my actions and my speech. My speech can raise someone or drop them into a hole. My actions can raise someone or drop them into a hole. Internally, it does the same thing. Right? So this is the specific way, all the shamatha piece is how we learn how to stay put. Calm, sit, stay. Right? Concentration practice, then, is the way we strengthen our ability to stay no matter how the wind is blowing. You know, the first couple of nights we were here, the wind was pretty wild and loud, right? And I assumed there was this horrible banging in my room, and I assumed it was something outside of my room. I mean, how's that for a metaphor for what's going on inside me, you know? I can't be nervous and anxious. It's got to be something outside of me. It's the way they're all looking at me in the room, right? So in my room, it was the same thing. It was a great metaphor. There was something outside my room that was causing the problem. So I went down the next day, and I checked all over. There was nothing hanging. This was a huge banging. I felt like a log was hitting the wall. There was nothing out there. And then I found out on the second night, the third night, it was the screen in the window that was offset. And that was what was banging. So, you know, I kind of pounded it in and went in. I had the most beautiful silent evening that I'd had in the two nights. But it just struck me, isn't that what we do, right? There's a problem, it's got to be outside of me. Right? So we practice. We have to practice with great effort to see that, you know, to see how we create the suffering for ourselves. Now, because we know we suffer, and because we know that every other person around us is no different from us, although that may be part of our practice, is to see that everyone else is the same as us, we become reluctant to do anything that would hurt anybody. Right. If I stub my toe on a coffee table that's in the way, that's you know, blocking the path, I wouldn't want anyone else to stub, because it hurts so badly, I wouldn't want anyone else to stub their toe either. So I might move the table. So, I mean, at a very concrete level, that's kind of what happens. You know, because hurtful words have hurt me, I begin to recognize, you know, if we all share this capacity to be hurt, then I wouldn't want to use those hurtful words with anybody else. So there's the beginning of our moral arc. Right, the beginning of our moral development. And we do this with kids, right? How would you like it if someone took your favorite toy and flushed it down the toilet? Right? There was one little kid said to me, I'd be okay because then I get another one. And I said, no, don't think that's what I meant. So when we begin to see how fleeting this world is, right? This whole world is fleeting, how filtered and dreamlike it is, and how easy it is to be unskillful, right? In our actions, thoughts, and speech. We become a little bit more careful. Because that moment where, you know, the words come out and I can't pull them back in again, it's gone, right? It comes out, it has a life, and it's gone, and there's nothing more I can do. about those words. So when we really experience it, like really deep in our hearts, in our body-mind, right, we're motivated to not cause harm. We're motivated to. Now, I mean, that's still sort of a felt sensation. I wouldn't want to do anything that hurt any of you in here by my way of being, by my actions, by my thoughts, by my, you know, by my speech, right? So I take up a commitment to develop this moral compass and to start looking at what's the congruence between my intention and my outcome. I talked about this before. You know, if my intention is to be kind and supportive and caring in this container, what's the outcome? Are people feeling that way? Or, you know, if they're not, can I pick up on it and address it in some way? Requires a certain courage to kind of turn towards our unskillfulness, right? Now, this is, you know, a fairly intense program that we've gone through. You know, we haven't given much space for things to consolidate. So it's more like an exposure thing, right? So, you know, we're in a time-compressed retreat. But in our lives, we have more space. So given we have more space in both, you know, our physicality and time, we have the opportunity to really drop into the impact of our actions when they aren't aligned with our values. You know, we have the drive home from work to kind of go, I wasn't really happy with how I handled that conversation. And we have the evening, you know, to sit down and kind of think, okay, that phone call with, you know, my friend, partner, child, parent, wasn't happy with how that turned out. Right? We have time for that to cook. It's like cooking a chickpea. It takes a little while. And then we have a chance to kind of align our compass with magnetic north. Compasses get misaligned very easily. All it takes is a highly charged experience, and that needle starts spinning. And sometimes it takes a magnetic experience, you know, experience that we're really drawn to and stuck to tip that compass over. But at least now, with the steadiness with the shamatha practice, we can start to be more attentive and be more discerning so that we can reset that compass more easily. Or we can recharge that compass more, but we can also reset our navigation. We can reset our course. You know, if I'm off course, the compass tells me I can reset it. The compass is off course, I got to do something a little bit more dramatic about that. So ultimately, I don't know that it matters whether we start with concentration and then grow into discernment and skillfulness, or whether we start practicing discernment and skillfulness and we grow into a steadiness. I think it can go either way. Conventionally, in Buddhist tradition, we start with ethics. We make a commitment to ethics, the five precepts, which are translated, we translate into the five skillful habits. And then we practice concentration, right? Out of that then wisdom arises. And because wisdom arises, we are more committed to being steady. Right? But within a Buddhist practice, you always start with ethics. Within the secular mindfulness field, it starts with the steadiness. And the assumption is that as you practice, you know, ethics spontaneously, moral action spontaneously arises. I'll get to that in a minute. Now, the complete practice of mindfulness, or what we call right mindfulness, or whole mindfulness, holistic mindfulness, requires both wisdom and compassion. So wisdom is the realization of all of these things, right? Nothing lasts, not even me, not even my sense of self. And I tend to play a fairly large role in how things go sideways in my life. Compassion is my willingness to be with that in a non-interfering way as I find skillful ways to change my path, change my direction. Now, the The interesting thing is that wisdom and compassion are the two wings of a holistic practice, right? They can't work without each other. Compassion without wisdom is what we call idiot compassion. That doesn't refer to you or to the person to whom you're giving the compassion. It refers to the idea that it's an uninformed compassion. It's a naive compassion. Right? Sharon Salzberg tells a story about being in, it's in her book on compassion, and she tells a story, no, it's a book, in her book on loving kindness. So she tells a story about being in India, and you know, she's in a rickshaw and she's got her purse and the driver's going along. And this man comes out of nowhere and grabs her purse, and he's running along the side of the rickshaw, kind of tugging on her purse, and she's tugging back. And she, you know, and she's just overwhelmed with this. I don't remember she says what happens to the purse, but she goes to her teacher and she says, "I'm practicing compassion. I this man was obviously starving, or you know, he was a beggar and he didn't have enough money. What should I have done? Should I have let him have my purse?" But at the same time, like, I need my money and I need my passport and I need all of these things to navigate through, you know, being here in India. And her teacher said, "Well, did you have an umbrella?" I said, "Well, yes." And she said, "Well, why didn't you use it?" And the idea is, you know, yes, give, but, and this is a, it comes from my Catholic background, you know, the nuns used to say, "Give until it hurts and then give some more." You know, be grateful here in this Buddhist kind of mental framework here, because what's left then? If we all gave until we hurt and gave some more, we'd be left with a whole world full of hurting, because no one would have anything to give to anybody anymore, right? I was working at the Royal. Down on Colling, and so I would come off Parkdale, and this was before Parkdale got all redesigned and confused me, so I'd come off Parkdale, and there was a sidewalk beside the road where there would always be this homeless man there, and he was a delight, he was an absolute delight. I'd roll down my window, and I'd give him my toonie. I always kept a loonie, because we didn't have toonies back then. I'm really dating myself. So I'd have like a couple of loonies, and so I would give him the loony, and he would then, we'd have a chat. It was really sort of an incoherent chat, but he loved talking to me. But I guess I sounded as incoherent as he did. And you know, he was just delightful. He was absolutely delightful. And he sort of wandered to the next car and always made sure that everything was safe. And it was getting cold. We were moving to autumn and winter. And I was getting really worried about him. And Frank had a winter coat that I decided he didn't need. It was an old coat. It was your barn coat. It was his favorite barn coat. I didn't know that at the time. Because, you see, I mean, this, like who would think he had a favorite barn coat? Look at the face. Right?
Who would think I experienced cold? Me.
You're so generous and kind and wonderful. I'm covering my ass here. So Ed, he did agree. I talked to him about it, and I said, you know, like, you've got a fantastic coat that you never wear. You've got a coat that you wear every day, and you've got the barn coat. So if I take the barn coat, the coat you wear every day can become your barn coat. This fantastic coat can become your everyday coat. Problem solved, right? Who needs three winter coats, for God's sakes? So, other than me. So I take this coat down. It really was a very nice coat. It was like downfilled a whole bit, and, you know, smelled a little like horses, but that's okay. So I pulled over when he was there. Like, I made sure there was no traffic behind me. You know, I pulled over, and I walked over to him with this coat, and he's like, "Really? Like, okay, there's this human being coming at me, you know? You're okay in your car, but you're dangerous when you're out of your car." And so I kind of stood back and I held out the coat and I said, you know, I want you to have this. And he wasn't sure about this, but eventually he kind of snuck up on me and he grabbed the coat and he still kind of looked very suspicious at me, and it was really sad to see how terrified he was that this was going to cost him somehow, right? But he took the coat, and he put it on, and he kind of looked at me, and he walked away. There was no idea, and I had no sense of, had I done good, had I done bad? Like, he wasn't giving me any feedback that I was the most wonderful Mother Teresa in the world, you know? All of which, you know, these ego things come up, right? I want you to tell me I done good, right? So that was a huge practice for me. I kind of sat there and thought, okay, fine, so he's wandered off. That was great. I can't remember if it was the next day or maybe that weekend you and I were going back down that way. And you come to the end of Park Hill, you turn, you go under an underpass, an overpass. And here was Frank's coat on the sidewalk. And I had no, and he was no, this man was nowhere around. I've never seen him again. I've never seen him again. Don't know what happened to the coat. I don't think we went back down that way again for a long time. And I had no idea what to do. I mean, you can imagine the horror stories that go through your head, right? I mean, we know what happens to homeless people. We know what happens when they have, you know, valuable things, valuable for their culture and their condition. And my immediate sense was I wanted to go looking for this person. I wanted to take that coat and go looking for this person and, you know, find them to make sure that they were okay. And I really had to stop and kind of go, okay, you have no control over this person's life. To do anything more comes pretty close to idiot compassion. Because it's really not for him, it's for me. I don't want to feel this awful sensation that something may have happened to this person because I gave them a coat. I don't want to have these images in my head about what might have happened to them. Lifespan on the streets is very short. But it was really personalizing it. It was really making it all about me. Right. And I mean, I think to some degree that's okay. But in the past, I think I would have gone to ridiculous extremes and upset a whole lot of people by pounding on the mission door and all of these places demanding to know where this person was. I couldn't describe this person, didn't know their name, didn't know where they lived, what shelter they lived at. Right. But it was interesting to see how an act of compassion, where I meant well, came so close to being derailed because of my own neediness, right? My need to know that what I had done good was going to be forever good. Right. So it was a real wake-up moment to recognize what compassion really is. The capacity to sit with, to be in the presence of suffering. That's what compassion means. Calm being with and passion being the derivative of suffering. To be in the presence of. To wish it were not here for that person. The suffering was not here for that person. But to also know that I have no power to make it go away. Because it's not mine. It's really hard when you're talking about a loved one. It's really hard when you're talking about a dear friend. I mean, if it was that hard talking about a homeless man with whom I had a momentary relational interchange, I'm sure, and I've been through, as Frank has, with people dear to us. It's very hard to sit and be in the presence of that and not feel motivated to do something. And the wisdom is in seeing that I want to do something in part because I don't like how I'm feeling because they're so upset. I'm getting upregulated because they're distressed. If I can just get them to not be distressed, then I won't suffer. Right. And so we start doing all kinds of controlling things. So self-compassion is a really important thing in that role. But self-compassion without the wisdom of what it is in me I'm trying to heal, I'm trying to learn how to be with, self-compassion without wisdom, are you ready for this? I call selfie compassion. It's the process of turning towards me and trying to make a big deal out of who I am as I'm being compassionate to myself. Now, we've all done selfies, you know that, right? In this day, in this technology, we've all taken little pictures of ourselves going, oh, look at me, I'm so happy, right? So self-compassion without wisdom has the capacity to increase our self-absorption. Self-compassion has to be in the service of being healthier in a relationship, because we're always in a relationship. So it's important to know the difference between wisdom is knowing that everything I do is in the service of enhancing a relationship by me, with myself or with others or with the world. So it does come down to ethics. In the end, wisdom is really about the moral stance that we take and knowing when and how to take those moral stands. There's a lot of debate. There's a lot of debate in the secular mindfulness world about including ethics or, you know, right action in mindfulness trainings and secular mindfulness trainings. You know, the argument is, should we practice ethical behaviors as part of mindfulness programs? Should we assume that if we don't explicitly teach it or practice it, they'll arise spontaneously? I don't believe they will, but, you know, it's one question. If we teach, you know, if we offer you, or having offered you the five skillful habits, are we imposing our perspective of what's right and wrong on you? Maybe you have a whole different moral framework, right? Are we secretly indoctrinating you into Buddhist beliefs? You know, are we stealthily making you all Buddhist and shooing you out the door? And you won't realize till you get home and you desperately want mala beads. And you can't go to sleep unless you have your zafu and zabuton set out, and you can throw all these terms around.
And the bells, you must.
Oh, bells! Oh, a whole array of them, right? Yes. I think we have more bells than oil lamps. But those are legitimate concerns, right? We've tried to stay away from the B word, and I feel like a real fake because I'm staying away from the B word, because, you know, that's who I am. But rest assured, we are not infusing the chocolate chip cookies with any desire to go out and take on robes or, you know, do 108 prostrations every morning. You'll be okay. But I do want you to consider that. You know, to what degree is anything that's been said this week congruent with how I want to live my life? If it's not, throw it out. You won't get a refund, but throw it out, right? But if it is, experiment with it. I mean, I think that's the beauty of the Buddha's teachings, is that it starts with, come and see. Come and try it out. You know, free trial. And if it works, awesome. It's still a free trial. Keep going. Right? If it doesn't work, you haven't lost anything. You know, you've had a bit of an adventure. Right? So I want to be really clear that our intent is not to convert. Buddhism has its own evangelical centers. And I've been in part of them, at least one of them. And you know when it's not right, you know when it doesn't feel right. Okay. And if the practice here this week has given you that deep sense of, I don't know if this feels right, then we've done our job. However that translates into your life, that's the wisdom that you're walking away with, which is, this doesn't feel right. Whatever's happening relationally here between me and the world, between me and my job, between me and my boss, between me and my partner, my children, my family, this doesn't feel right. That's all you need to know. How that plays out is completely up to you. Okay. I think once you know deeply inside you what feels right for you, in a true way, you know, not in a self-serving way, right? What feels right for me is 3 dozen chocolate chip cookies, but, and, you know, there are days when I think that's the solution to everything I'm suffering. But I know that that's not what I mean by right. You know, what feels right is what am I avoiding? And how can I turn towards it? It's like when your car is in a skid, I am told if your car is in the skid, to turn into the skid. I've not figured out if turn into the skid means this way or that way, but that's different. I don't get into skids. I drive carefully, unlike some people I know. So turn into the skid. This is about turning into our suffering, right? Which we don't like doing. The one thing I will say, while taking a mindfulness course, coming to a 5-day silent retreat, going to a 10-day silent retreat, and you're going to find it, I hope you become feel addicted to this process of, and you start going to 10-day retreats, you know, twice a month or something like that. You know, as long as it's here. I mean, we do. We do get addicted to these things, and that's okay, and at some point the addiction's gone too. The only time I worry is when we lose sight of how we weaponize the calming skills. If I have got my shamatha really down pat, as if I ever could, it can start becoming a way of actually avoiding things. So in our, and this is a huge debate I've been having with the larger mindfulness community globally, because we always, we're kind of the rogues in the field. And so I raise this issue of people who come into the program, because, you know, we don't do a diagnostic. People come into the program. We don't know how they're going to use it. We hope that they're going to use it for good. But in the program, sometimes we will hear people say things like, I am so grateful I learned how to do this. I'm so calm now that, you know, I can be angry and still stay calm. And if, you know, my partner says, you know, you're being unfair, you're using your anger against me, I can just say, but I'm being mindful about my anger. You know, I'm being mindful about, you know, and yeah, my answer to that is no. That's not what we mean by being mindful. I'm mindful about my anger means I know I'm about to do something really stupid here, so I need to step back, take a breath, assess the situation, find the kindest path through it, if possible. Sometimes it may not be possible. Sometimes anger is a very justifiable response, but it's not. As a constant source of energy, it's a toxic source of energy. But there have been occasions where we've come up against individuals using mindfulness as a strategic way of getting their own way. How do you argue with someone who says, oh, but I'm being mindful. Right? I'm only doing this because I feel compassion for you. Right? So now you know that's, you know, the far enemy of compassion. Right? So for me, I think that's a real touchy point in terms of how do we in, you know, our practice, navigate around something like that. You know, I have no doubt that all of you in here are honorable, honest, and transparent people. And I mean that sincerely, and that's not a joke at all, because I have that sense as you practice, as you sit here, you're really courageous at diving deep. But the world is not like that. And the world is made up of people who enjoy using it in a particular way. Not very many. So don't be derailed if you come across that. Don't assume that that too is mindfulness, because it's not. I will draw my line there. You know, that is not. Okay. Mindfulness for me is realizing a is an appropriate response to every situation. Right. And what Frank and I have hoped that we've done is that we've given you the opportunity to have faith in the practice. We've given you the opportunity to show yourselves what diligent practice can bring you. From, you know, talking in the group, I know this diligent practice has taken you to some, you know, dark neighborhoods. But I think you found your way back, back on the train, back to the train station. Right? We hope as well, so I mean, I'm talking about great faith, you know, great effort and great doubt. We hope that we've given you the skills, or at least an introduction to the skills, so that that negative mind doesn't have the same amount of traction in generating shame and blame. I wish we had another 5 days to talk about shame and blame. Right? But you know, once you shine the light on a situation that's generating shame, shame disappears. Because shame only survives in the dark and in secret. If you shine the light on it, it implodes, it goes away. It may come back, but you shine a light on it again. Shame and blame are what I call eroding doubt. That's what it erodes our self-confidence. It erodes our confidence in ourselves. The great doubt I'm talking about, the doubt that, you know, every thought is a fact, every thought is a command, that great doubt is the refusal to believe that everything the mind throws up. I do mean throw up, right? Because it's just this effluent that keeps going. So wisdom is just that. Wisdom is the capacity to know that, yeah, there's impermanence, non-self, and suffering, and I cause my own suffering. Yes, all good. But wisdom is also to know what's required. You know, am I being called, is equanimity being called forward? Is compassion being called forward? Is self-compassion being called forward? Is loving-kindness being called forward? Can I be my own best friend? Is joy called forward? Because without joy and friendliness and what we call kalyanamitras, which are spiritual friends who are supportive, without joy and loving kindness in a community of people who practice the same or who see it the same, equanimity and compassion are very hard to call up. But because of shame, we self-isolate, so we don't give ourselves a chance to be in a community of friends who can be supportive of our practice. And that's where shame has traction. So shamatha, calming breath, connection with the body, vipassana, the insight into the nature of our existence. But wisdom, which is not just insight, but wisdom is knowing what's required. So the shamatha and vipassana clean the data. Wisdom gives us an accurate prediction of what's required. What's required right now are cookies. Bill, wait, you got the bell. So again, remembering to hold this container of silence as we start to even let our guard down a little bit.